All right, let's be sure that you're in fellowship. I'm sure everyone is. The optimist. Anyway, you need to rebound, do so. Keep yourself in fellowship. Before we begin with this, a couple observations. I know it's a hot topic among some of you, and that has to do with the eclipse, the solar eclipse that's going to be here this month. And the solar eclipse typically is not a good omen. I mean, they're not a harbinger of good things are going to happen. That's just the way they are. And historically, they have been demonstrated to be that with regard to the nations in particular. Now, lunar eclipses are bad news for Israel, but the solar eclipse, because see, Israel had a lunar calendar, 12 months, 30 days, so forth, and added a leap month every 4 years, I guess. But anyway, this is going to happen, and of course, it cuts diagonally across the entire United States. Here in Oklahoma City, it'll be about an 80% viewing if the atmosphere is free of clouds. Even then, it'll darken. Do not look at it with your sunglasses, okay? You can go up to Ace Hardware and buy some of those little funky things and look at it with that. Don't do it. Don't do that. It's stupid. But anyway, that's going to happen in August this month. And next month, the date that would be, in other words, the 23rd is going to be 1 Tishri. This is the birth of Christ. Christ was born. See, I said 12 months each. It was easy to keep track of. Every month had 30 days in it, and so they added days later to make it work. And they had a leap month or an extra month they threw in. And there's a name for it. But the first month of their civil year and what we would call our New Year's was 1 Tishri. That means nothing to the average person that isn't familiar with the Jewish terminology and the Jewish calendar. Just like Passover is, you know, in the month Nisan, and so forth and so on. So, and that starts their religious calendar. So they had 2 New Years. One of them was a religious one, starting with Passover, and the other one was their civil one. Well, what was the big deal about it? Well, that, for instance, during the period of the kings, whenever a new king took the throne, succeeded his father, that was when they crowned him. You know, kind of like our inauguration, there's an inauguration, a formal inauguration for a new president. Anyway, the year of Christ's birth is 3 BC. And if we took our calendar back in time and were using it, it would be September the 11th, 3 BC. But because it changes every year, depending on the calendar, which you can go online or wherever and find out when the birth of Christ, what year or what day in the month that it occurs. This year, 2017, it'll be the 23rd of September. Okay? Those of you who have been in Bible class know Jesus wasn't born on the 25th of December. But anyway, that's off topic. The astrological phenomena, and you know that from Genesis, God established the luminaries, he called lights, L-I-G-H-T-S, into 3 categories. What we call the stars, the moon, and the sun. Now, why don't we just turn to it? Turn to Revelation, and then we'll come back here and get back on topic. But I just want to let you know this. Revelation 12, verse 1. God established the luminaries that he specified in Genesis for the purpose, and one of their purposes is for signs. Now people that aren't familiar with this think of the zodiac, and they think of all the stuff and all the pagan names attached to this. Obviously, Satan likes to hijack stuff and start his own deal. He's not particularly original. Because it's all about trying to subvert God's plan with his BS. That's what he does. He's good at it. I got to give him that. He's very good at it. But originally, the original so-called 12 signs, the constellations, each one of them tells something and is a picture of something relative to the plan of God. And the naming and all the little lines that line up all these particular stars and how it all works. All right. It is lost on most people. Men have written books about it. There's one book called The Gospel and the Stars. I mean, it was written in the 19th century, I think. Where it's an attempt to identify these different things that we know by the pagan names, but what they originally were and what they symbolized. I mean, it's about Christ, it's about the gospel, it's about Israel, it's about the second coming, the first advent. It's all in there. I mean, it's phenomenal. Okay, here's one of them. Now, when Christ was born, we've all heard of the Star of Bethlehem. Well, what in the world is the Star of Bethlehem? Well, what you had was one of the familiar constellations is Virgo, the Virgin. It's a woman. Okay. It always is. Now, Virgo is a woman, and at the birth of Christ, here's the situation. The sun was in mid-body, positioned mid-body in Virgo. She had the moon at her feet. That's where the moon was. All right. Also, in her area where she would carry a child was Jupiter. And it was in retrograde, and it was in there for 9 months. That's an odd number, isn't it? No, it's mimicking a pregnancy. And it's moving. When Christ was born, Jupiter was standing directly over a little village. Not like shine a light straight down. It may disperse out here to the sides, but straight down like a laser, it's over a village called Bethlehem, not over Jerusalem, which is only 10 miles away from Bethlehem. The birthplace of Christ is by the prophet Micah was way ahead. It was revealed to him that the Messiah, he would get his humanity and be born physically in the little nondescript village that was just a dot on the road, a few little houses called Bethlehem. And the star appeared in its retrograde motion to settle right over the village when he was born. In Virgo. Okay, now read this one, and I'll make comment. A great sign. Don't underestimate the word great. There's signs. We all know what a sign is. Curve ahead. Go 40 miles an hour. If you're a dummy, you'll go 70. But if you accept the sign for what it says, it isn't the curve, but it is warning you or telling you, cautioning you with regard to what's about to come up. We use all kinds of these. So the sign here is called a great one. It's not some insignificant one. It's great. And one would have to define why it was great. Appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. Well, we know what the 12 stars symbolize, don't we? Whatever stars they are, they're called stars, and they are 12, so that's got to be the 12 tribes of Israel. You know, the Messiah came in the world, and it's through the Jews that salvation has come to humanity. He's a Jew. All right? Obviously, he came out of one tribe, and he came out of one deal. But all the tribes are participants in this great drama of bringing Messiah into the world. I mean, you can't. Everyone had a role to play, and it all came down. Now, on September the 23rd, I was told, I haven't checked it out personally, so I'm on a little bit on a limb, but I was told that this sign, this particular one, will occur on the 23rd, and it's never occurred before or since. It occurs once in 7,000 years. Now, the sign of what I told you about the birth of Christ, it has occurred, not a lot, but you could find out how often that phenomena occurred. And, of course, reviewing everything from Israel. The difference in this one, apparently, is the 12-star crown. Make of it what you will. I was teasing Brent. I said, "You got a little over a month to get your act together." I was kidding. It was a joke. Not predicting anything. She didn't say anything catty or nothing. Anyway, that's just a fact. That is going to occur. And, of course, we're all in what is called the rapture watch thing. The problem I have with it being the rapture is we don't have a temple. And a temple is very important. Israel became a nation in 1948, officially, May 14th. They gained control for the first time since 70 AD over the city of Jerusalem as a result of a war with Jordan, and they gained Jerusalem, sovereignty over it. That's just sovereignty over Jerusalem. So what becomes an issue? Order of events. The land. And of course, Jerusalem's a really big deal because that's where God is going to put his Messiah to rule over the nations. Satan knows this, so he's going to try to put the Antichrist in power there. And he will, for a time, have power over Jerusalem because of a bunch of negative Jews that will sign a treaty with him. But anyway, so it's the order of events. The land, Jerusalem, and then what's left? The temple. Now, all religions regard that piece of land where there is this gold dome mosque, the most iconic symbol of the skyline of Jerusalem. I've looked at it, you know, from the Mount of Olives, looking west, because Mount of Olives is higher terrain than Jerusalem proper. Not by a lot, but it's higher. So it's a perfect way to look at it all. Now, all religions, Christian, the Jews, and of course those that are of the Islam faith, they all regard that land sacred. We went up on the Temple Mount, my wife and I. We went up there and saw all these people. And there's inside, first of all, you have to take your shoes off. There's all these Persian carpets on the ground. And then encased and protected in this glass, kind of plexiglass or whatever it is, is this rough stone. It's not smoothed out, cut. It's like an outcropping that you would see somewhere where it's all uneven. And all these people think that's sacred. I mean, I saw people bowing down like they were worshiping the thing. I mean, I was just an observer of it. The point I'm trying to get at is they all think that's the Jews and the Christians, and I'll take them out, they think that's where the temple ought to go. Putin was over there in recent time, and the Jews are praying, and that's one of the things they're doing. They're praying for this temple. So he says he was all for it. And I heard Trump was all for it too, that they get their temple. Well, that's going to cause a ruckus. Because the Arabs aren't just going to, the Palestinians, which I think, if I'm proven wrong, then I will correct that. But for now, I think the Palestinians that are vying for a state and it's our land and all that business, they're descendants of Esau, not Ishmael. Don't confuse the racial thing with the religion of Islam. I mean, there's Islam people in the Philippines. They don't have anything to do with Ishmael and Esau. I mean, that's all spread all over. So I think they're the modern version. They're the Edomites. Esau had a nickname. He had red hair. He was got a reddish skin. So they called him Red. That's what Edom means, Red. And the area they lived in, which is close to Israel, in today, look, type in P-E-T-R-A, Petra. This was their mountain fortress. And it's cut in there, and there's columns cut into the rock, and it was considered impregnable. And that's where the Edomites lived and resided in Old Testament times. But I don't think the Esau descendants got amalgamated and lost in the mix or went out of existence. They're still around to torment Israel. Just like the Ishmaelites. The Ishmaelites would be more like the people in Saudi Arabia and the desert dwellers. What I'm getting at is something's got to happen to that Dome of the Rock. Obviously, you can't. You've got to remove it. And they're not going to build a temple next to it. And we're going to just be happy, and we got our temple here, you got this. It's got to go. So whether God takes it out with an earthquake, or there's some kind of a war and it gets blown up, it's going to cause a war with the Palestinians. There's going to be a major war between the Jews and the Palestinians. And all this skirmishing and back and forth that's been going on for decades, it's going to ramp up and there's going to be a final climax and conclusion to it. So what I was saying about Israel, in order for the tribulation to be up and running, one of the things that has to be in place is a temple. They haven't had a temple since 70 AD. They operate, they call their synagogues, the Jews will say, going to synagogue, they'll say, I'm going to temple. Well, you know what they mean. It's back, we lost our temple. And that's a part of our history and culture. So the Trib Temple, all the plans, all the details, everything they need to get it up and running, they have done tons, the Temple Mount faithful, they have done tons of detailed research so they know the precise uniforms a priest ought to wear, replicating the musical instruments, getting the ritual, everything. And then, of course, there's the physical structure itself, where every year at least once they have kind of a parade and they get a big old truck, flatbed truck, and they have one of these stones on it that they've got them already cut. So it would go up pretty fast. But it has to serve the tribulation, the entirety of it. The first half of it, the Kohen, the priests of Israel, they will serve the ancient ritual in Israel. In modern times, we will see a prominent world religion practicing animal sacrifice. That'll get PETA all upset. But they're going to see that in modern times. And the ritual isn't going to be pagan and infiltrated with Masonic crap and everything. It's going to be the right thing. If you read Revelation, there's none of this. And then, of course, in the middle of the trib, 3.5 years in, the Antichrist causes, it says in Daniel, sacrifice and something to cease. Because he's the deal. Things are really incredible. And so the Jews are going to make a pact with the devil, a covenant of death, the negative Jews, the leaders. They're going to declare the Antichrist the Messiah, and he's not even a Jew. But it never bothers people when they want to be stupid. They'll go any directions. Don't say, well, they'd never buy into a non-Jewish Messiah. Don't count on it. Don't count on it for a minute. He happens to be a Gentile. They're going to declare him Messiah. And he's going to run all that out of there, shut down all the ritual, and put his artificial intelligence thing in the most holy place, the most sacred. You know, the tabernacle and temple will divide into three areas. The outer court, the holy place where the priests went and did, referring to phase two, and then this inner sanctum, which represents heaven, which corresponds to what? Man, a believer, is a three-part entity, body, soul, and spirit. Body is the outer court. Soul is the holy place. Spirit, most holy place. It's a trinity of things. I know. And it's things to think about. But anyway, we obviously are looking at momentous events. And God does have a timing schedule for all this. I'm just saying this is what's happening in September. So, any more insights? If there is any more, main thing for you and I to do is stay positive, stay in fellowship, and suffer whatever you're suffering. And we're back to our topic. I don't care what a pressure and what a problem it is. God will not abandon you. You're going to get through it. You will get through it. You can't expect to get the prize and just coast. Everything's going to be good. I want to coast. I want to coast to the rapture. I'd like to put my car in neutral and just coast down this hill. But I think I won't be able to. I'm not looking for anything. I'm not asking for anything. But I got to deal with people. And the worst I've ever had to deal with, that could change, are members of my own assembly. Gave me the most grief. Typically. It's too bad, isn't it? But that's just the way it is. That's what I should have known when I took the job. Should have anticipated this might happen. All right. Peter deals with undeserved suffering as seen in the expressions, doing what is right. Sarah was our example for you ladies. We have a separate doctrine for you to look this up on your own, the doctrine of Sarah's daughters. You want to be in the most exclusive, coveted club of all forever, that you'll have the crown. You're the Sarah's daughter. You don't have to be married to get this, by the way. You just have to act appropriately, and you can secure it. We're in 1 Peter 2 or 3. Get it here. This doing what's right. 3:3, let me exit from there and go to verse 19, suffering unjustly, to 19. So that's a big theme throughout his letter. For this finds favor, if for the sake of conscience towards God, a person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. See, there's your undeserved suffering. In verse 19, 3:13, just quickly, 3:13, who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? You know, it's like saying, all right, if you do what's right, and whatever that is, and it poses a threat, who is that? It's nothing. It's nothing. Don't worry about it. Oh, yeah, they can give you a lot of grief, but they can't change the truth, and you'll be vindicated, and things will take care of themselves. Verse 14, but even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, and who hasn't? Suffer for the sake of righteousness. You are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation. And do not be troubled. But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. Occupation with Christ. Recognizing that he went through it, and he was facing all kinds of people that contradicted him and mocked him and carried on. Always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you. What is this you believe down there? The best of your ability, with the doctrine you have, you give them the information. And I know some of you do that with people. Yet with gentleness and respect. You don't have to scream and yell. Here's the truth. Calm. You're calm. They may not be calm, but you can be calm. Let them make a out of themselves by raising their voice and turning red in the face and yelling. That's not what we do. We just tell people the way it is. You know, we want them to understand clearly and with gentleness. This is the plan. It shows your humility. You're presenting a doctrine to them. What do you believe about? And there you are. You're on the spot. Now, again, like I said, if you don't have an answer for it because you maybe not know everything, you say, I can get an answer for you. I know a church where I can get an answer. Oh, that church. And here they go. Let them go. Let them go. You know, we're still being called a cult because we don't fellowship with the stupid. That's why we get the tag cult, because we don't lovey-dovey and all Christians are right and this is just wonderful and mess with that. We don't hate these people. We hate their doctrines and their approach to stuff. That's legitimate. So we do our thing. And so we're called a cult. Now, if you can't handle being called names, you're not anywhere. You've humbled yourself enough to do this. That's share the sufferings of 4:13. But and this is exactly what Paul taught. But we saw Paul teaching his people. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing. You say, well, that's hard to do. No, it isn't. If you get on top of it, you can find joy in something you never suspected. Keep on rejoicing. So that also at the revelation of his glory, that's when it is manifest. The rapture. This is the revelation of his glory. For us, that is the rapture event. You may rejoice with exultation. Not just a low-key, yeah, no. Exultation is at a higher level of in-your-face celebration. Like people are given to do when they win some event. They go nuts. You know? This is the kind of celebration we're talking about. You want to be in that circle. And now that is at the top of your prayer list. It's about you getting and keeping yourself where you need to be. This epistle deals with the persecutions by those outside, mainly at the point, looking close at this letter, it was mainly that they were being vilified verbally. There may be other things going on, but they were being vilified because, you know, again, you break from your culture. You're a traitor. This culture was good enough, you got blood and all this, and you broke from those aspects of it that are not good. People, they resent that. They want everybody on board. Thing. No. The cohesiveness of a civilization. Everybody has to be on board. No. The Christian was saying that all this stuff that we're taught about deity and religion is wrong. It's the ticket to hell, the road to hell. We got off it. And that, by the way, saying, you mean I'm going to hell? Yes, if you don't believe in Jesus Christ. What else can I tell you? If you don't get off of that and get on this, that's where you're gonna break into. And people definitely resent having this. And so and imagine it's family, it's people close to you, it's your mother, it's your, you know, siblings. It's these people. They're going to rise up and they're going to give you flack. I can tell you how to deal with it. I make it simple. They aren't going to bully me. I'm going to try to be nice enough, but I'm going to be firm. No. They can tell, oh, you're ruining your life. You could have been this. You could have been that. I had all this stuff come down on me at a certain point when I didn't have nearly the doctrine I do now. I said, no, I'm going this way. So I am going. Make it look as bad as you want it. Such suffering finds favor with God. Again, you might think because you're suffering that you're out of divine favor. You're not. When you suffer persecution for your belief system, from whoever source it comes, this suffering finds favor with God. For this finds favor. Okay, we read that. And again, saying, you know, don't get yourself in trouble with society. That type of suffering, if you act up, do something to get yourself in trouble with the authorities, that doesn't bring glory to God. 1 Peter 3:14. Obviously, you can recover from that. Okay, I'm gonna move on through this. In other words, you got the idea here. One other one I wanted to give you at the very end on G. Believers are not to be surprised when negative volition rises up, persecutes, and maligns them. Again, 1 Peter 4:12, but 1 John 3:13. See the consistency of Scripture? 1 John 3:13. And do not be surprised, brethren, if the cosmos hates you. Don't be in some kind of shock. What are they like me for? I'm a good citizen. I do what I'm supposed to do. I'm not giving them any problems. The world, darkness doesn't like the light. It's a good analogy and it sticks. The mental attitude towards suffering that adjusted believers are to possess. There's inner peace, inner happiness, and you must be willing to conform and suffer and endure. You got to go through the test. Also in this, and I'm moving fast now so we can get back into Hebrews. We can get back into some book. James 1, 2 through 4. Another example. And he's not dealing just with persecution here. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various tests. Now, I have to always explain that. It's not, oh, giddy, goody. Oh, I'm just so happy. It's looking at, this is producing SG3 for me. Knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. You know something. That this isn't a dead end, suffering gains no advantage. It's gonna produce in me. See, the idea is we're in a race. And what do you need is stick-to-itiveness. You need endurance. And tests prepare you for the next round and the next round. Jesus was prepared for what came at the end as a result of a lifetime of going through various things. And let endurance have its perfect result so that you may be perfect, mature, and complete, lacking in nothing. So that's that. Suffering and surpassing grace in eternity. If people are persecuting you for coming here, believing what you believe, they're handing you SG3. Jesus says, when they persecute you and malign you for my name's sake, rejoice, your reward in heaven is great. Shushing, you just rang up some more big SG3. Not just your everyday smaller stuff, big SG3. When you do not allow those that rise up against you to dissuade you from pressing forward. So this is how we accumulate SG3. So there's that aspect that you keep in mind. We've had the comfort aspect, the mental attitude you're to have under it. Those who remain positive under various testing and suffering associated with the body of death reap SG3. And I like this one because I know some of you, I know myself, it applies to all of us in some way or another. If you're young and you're in good health, you may not see much in this, but anyway, 2 Corinthians 4:17, actually was 16. Therefore, we do not lose heart, but though our outer man, that's your body, you know, that's your, with your skin and flesh and bones, that our outer man is decaying. There's your old aging gene that catches up with everybody. Yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. Bible class, face-to-face teaching. For momentary light affliction. You know, some of these tests are really big and they may be momentary, but they sure aren't viewed as light. Even if you've got something that's chronic that you're going to have to the end of your life. And that's not going to be much longer. For a momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. There's your eternal reward factor called eternal weight of glory. Far beyond all comparison means you can't compare it to any good things of this life, material things, etc., that even compares to it. Doesn't hold a candle to it. It's shabby. While we look not at the things which are seen, Our focus is not on the end all, be all is the cosmos and the things out there, but at the things which are not seen, for things which are seen are temporal. We got the right perspective. That new car, it's temporal. That new home, it's temporal. That vacation is temporal. You probably already forgot about the thing. It went so fast. Oh, you had a good time. Well, I'm not bad mouth. I'm just saying, you know, it's temporal. You're not going to have to break from your enjoyment of phase three to go back to, you know, the routine. But the things which are not seen are eternal. That's what we're here about, to get you to get your focus. And it's a process. Believe me, I didn't do it overnight. I didn't throw some switch and it's all just right. It's looking at the things which are not seen and getting yourself in the best possible position to build up your eternal rewards account. That requires faith. I believe it is true. I believe that SG3 is important. I believe I need to produce it. So you go out there today, and until we meet again, and you suffer whatever's out there. God, all His promises are intact. He's going to feed you. He's going to clothe you. He's not going to forsake you. You've got prayer. You get in fellowship. Help me to deal with this, God. Help me to get through it. I can't do it for you. All I can do is encourage you as to what you ought to do. I can't, you know, substitute myself for you. I got my own things I've had to deal with and continue to deal with. All right, we'll stop here and we'll be back in Philippians the next time we meet. Thank you, Father, for all of your many acts of mercy and goodness towards us. Help us to see and appreciate what a privilege it is to be a positive believer in these last days. Watch over and protect us and keep us alert. In Christ's name, amen.